thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News, Larry Mueller. And you know what? It's a physical therapy day. And we're going to start by talking about lower back pain a bit with our two guests, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill's a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to see you.
It's great to be here.
And Lori is a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, good to see you as well.
Awesome to be here on a warm and sunny day.
A little humid.
A little humid. Sticky. You could swim through it today.
Yes. Yeah, not one of those days you want to be out there trying to run a...
Right. 30 miles or so.
You're not going to, because of the humidity, you're not going to be able to dissipate your heat. So,
right.
You know,
when I biked to work this morning, I saw many people running very early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
7:30 out in the conservancy, things like that.
Right.
I was out at 6.
Yep.
Fine then.
Yeah.
Well, it was still warm, but it was better, but
it is the humidity. So people think, oh, I'm sweating, so I'm getting cool. But you only cool your core if your sweat evaporates.
Right.
If your sweat drips off of you or you wipe it off of you, you are not cooling your core. So if there's a lot of humidity in there, you can't evaporate your sweat. You can't cool your core. So it's a dangerous situation.
It is.
Well, I tell you what, as you listen to these two experts, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. We're going to start talking. Well, we just started by talking about heat and humidity, but we're going to talk about some research done on exercise relating to lower back pain and questions about that. Maybe you have had some lower back pain or maybe you have another physical therapy issue. Certainly welcome to join in. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Jill, let's start with you on this study. What was the lower back pain study all about?
So this group, as we know, the prevalence of low back pain is very high. About 80% of the population will experience an episode of low back pain within their lifetime. And Larry, you are in that club. Unfortunately, you had one episode. And then because you're healthy and you did the right things, you went on your merry way. But what we wanted to know is, could we decrease the incidence of low back pain through exercise? And we know that exercise is kind of this golden nugget for almost everything. But what this group in particular wanted to do is they wanted to see kind of what the sweet spot was. In other words, is there a set amount of exercise that really is associated with decreasing the incidence of low back pain? So they looked at 365,000 people. So they had a very, very large cohort. And their age group was between 37 and 73. When they started the study, nobody had low back pain. They followed them prospectively with a self-reported information, and then they looked at which people had the highest incidence of low back pain, who reported an incidence of low back pain, and how much exercise did that those people who had the lowest incidence of low back pain, where was their sweet spot? So that was one of the things they looked at, and Lori's going to give you the answer to that. And then the other thing they looked at is, if you swapped out an hour of sedentary lifestyle for an hour of physical activity, would that make a change? And I know we talked about watching golf yesterday and watching baseball yesterday. And so there are some times where we do find ourselves sedentary for a prolonged period of time. But that's just a one-time incident. These are people who are sedentary day in, day out. And if they took one of those hours and flipped it for some exercise, would that make a difference? So they looked at all this, and Lori found kind of the sweet spot of how much exercise is the most appropriate.
So they looked at light, moderate, and vigorous activity, and those are well-defined in the literature. And they found that the best dose to decrease back pain is 360 minutes of light exercise, 150 minutes of moderate exercise, or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise per week, or any combination thereof, which is really interesting because that is completely consistent with the World Health Organization and the American College of Sports Medicine exercise guidelines. They say 150 minutes of moderate exercise per week, and that can include some cardio, some stretching, some balance activities, etc. So you can mix and match some light activity, some moderate, and some vigorous to have a well-rounded program. And that amount of activity results in a decreased incidence of low back pain. So you're really talking about take an hour where maybe you sit down after dinner and you watch Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy. And instead of doing that, get up and take a walk for an hour. Or, you know, if you're watching that show, you're doing some squats or some leg lifts or some yoga stretches while that's going on. So just changing out the sitting for something more active.
And I think a really nice way to think about it, or what could I change, is how many times do we say, well, let's meet for coffee. So why don't we meet for a walk through this beautiful park and then maybe sit down and have a little bit of coffee or something like that? So I think a lot of meetings and some of our socialization could be rethought, and you could consider making that a moving activity instead of a sedentary activity.
So in advance of this, I sat down this morning and looked at my run lap for last week, and I had to do the kind of quick math, but I did 500 minutes.
Okay,
great.
Well,
there you go.
There you go.
That's not too much, but
No. The only time you get into trouble, according to this study, is if you do too many minutes of vigorous activity, and that was most common in the younger males in this cohort.
Mm-hmm. So, which doesn't surprise us.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, and it's important to note that the follow-up on this was the median was 13 years. So it wasn't like they followed these people for a year. And one of the caveats is, you know, over time, you know, they sort of average this. Over time, people may have changed their activity level, and sometimes you lose some of that data in the wash. But this is a very long follow-up with a very large cohort.
And I think the fact that it mirrors what the World Health Organization has been giving us for guidelines and the American College of Sports Medicine is very helpful.
Yeah.
And I also think it's very helpful that, as you mentioned, Lori, there's variety. It could be light, it could be moderate, it could be vigorous. And so you don't have to force yourself into a certain type of exercise to achieve these goals.
Right. Yeah.
And if you want to know how those are defined, that's an easy Google search. Like, how do you define light, moderate, or vigorous? And they have examples of activities. They have charts on the websites and various. So you can take a look and look at those list of activities and say, oh, yeah, I didn't think about this or I didn't think about that. And I can add that to my usual activities.
I was trying to think of, I don't know if the golf got included. I had one 9 holes of golf I don't think I included, but that was walking, so
great.
3-mile walk.
That's a great.
Yeah, that's absolutely included.
And Larry, I think the other thing you don't think about is I know where you park, and I know you intentionally park far away from the studio.
Mile away.
So you get a walk in, and I bet you don't consider that as part of it, but that would be part of your light physical activity to walk that 2-mile walk every day or 5 days a week.
Yeah.
So all those things can add up.
So, I'm looking at this chart, and golf walking, 44 metabolic equivalents. It's considered a moderate activity.
Oh, okay.
So there you go. Yeah.
You're swinging a lot. You're pushing around.
Exactly.
Right. There's a lot of body parts involved.
Bending over, rotating. Yep.
Depending upon how many times you have to bend over to pick up your ball.
Exactly.
Or tee, and every time you tee out.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So there. All right. I'm glad to hear that. Dave and Nina have something that relates to back pain, so let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hello. After working a sedentary job for 30 years, when I finally retired, I was at the point where I was somewhat deconditioned and had to stop driving about every hour and a half because of my low back pain and sciatica. So now 5 years later, I've been with the trainer for 3.5 years, 3 days a week, and I can drive as many hours as I want because of my core strength and conditioning. And so I guess that falls exact mirrors exactly what that means.
Yeah, it does. Sounds like it.
Oh, yeah.
Laura?
We love those case reports that validate what we see in the literature. And we see that all the time. There's so much work now that is sedentary rather than physical.
Right.
And people don't realize how deconditioned they're becoming until it hits some tipping point. Mm-hmm. And then you have back pain, hip pain, knee pain, neck pain, you name it. So it's good that you took charge of it when you stopped that job and got in with a trainer so someone could give you some guidance. Because if you go out and start something on your own, you don't do the right things or you do too much too early and you end up with an injury, and then there's a disincentive to exercise and so on.
Right.
So
and,
you did it right.
And it could be overwhelming to go to a gym mm-hmm. and look at all those
yeah.
devices and machines and not have any idea how to use them or set them up.
And all those fit-looking people.
And all those fit-looking people.
And spandex and Lycra. Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly.
So I want to go back for just a minute, though, to that one-hour business.
Mm-hmm.
Here's somebody who's, let's say we've got somebody who does not get out,
mm-hmm.
and 1 hour a week or what, you know, just getting up and going for an hour somewhere, it makes a difference.
Yeah, an hour a day.
An hour a day.
An hour a day, not an
yeah.
hour a week.
So light.
Hour a day.
Right, so light, leisurely, stroll around the neighborhood, maybe you walk your dog.
Walk around the block.
Maybe you break it up. Mm-hmm. So it's frequently throughout the day. Maybe you do 4 15-minute walks to start
mm-hmm.
to kind of condition yourself. That's very appropriate. There's a gentleman in my neighborhood in his 70s, and he has a dog named Betty, little white thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he, every time I walk my dog, he is out and about walking his dog, which
mm-hmm.
is great.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're walking different hills, different terrains, and he and Betty are out and about all the time,
mm-hmm.
which is great.
Yeah. Good for you, Dave.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Dave. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Kay in Sister Bay, thank you for calling.
Oh, sure. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Kay.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'm just wondering about your opinion of using Tai Chi movement to assist with range of motion for an individual with Parkinson's.
So that's a great question. So the question is, what about Tai Chi movements to help someone with Parkinson's? There is some very good research with regards to the benefits of Tai Chi with regards to balance and strength, and I'm guessing that would carry over into an individual with Parkinson's. They may need some modifications of the Tai Chi program, but I definitely think that that would be something that could be beneficial. You'd have to make sure you started that individual at the right level so they weren't at risk for a fall. But one thing we know with Parkinson's patients is they also benefit from music and beat and dance and rhythm. So I'm wondering if Tai Chi might be helpful in that category.
Right. There are classes for people who have Parkinson's,
mm-hmm.
and I think they pull in some of that information and some of those techniques. There's also techniques called, if I get this right, LVST Big, where you make big sounds and big movements, because Parkinson's people tend to have trouble initiating movement. They take small steps. They speak softly. So there is a program that is designed specifically to work the other direction and talk loudly, make big movements, take big steps, and so on. So that's also available out there.
Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest today, taking a look at physical therapy. We've started with lower back pain, but obviously taking other physical therapy questions as well. You can join in. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on our physical therapy day with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Always great to have them come by. I want to remind you, we're gearing up for our June member drive. The drive is just a one-day drive on the 27th, and we're looking for 500 people to get us started. And when we reach that goal, if we do it before the 27th, WPR programs will receive an additional $10,000 from a group of generous donors. So you can be one of those first 500. We should have a T-shirt.
Yeah.
That says first 500. Mm-hmm. Anyway, easy to do it. Just get it going. Your gift will be much appreciated at WPR.org/donate. So there you go. Let's take some calls. Barbara in Fort Atkinson, it's your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 75-year-old recently retired woman. And I have arthritis. It's mostly in my right hip. And I'm wondering if there's some exercises that would help that.
Oh, my, yes.
Absolutely. Where does one begin?
Exactly, exactly. So I assume you saw your doctor, perhaps, and maybe they took some x-rays and you noted some arthritis. And I expect that you're having some symptoms there, which is probably what took you in the first place. So I would start with seeing a physical therapist who could look at your hip range of motion, your mobility. Have you lost mobility there? Look at your strength and the muscles around your hip and in your core. Look at your mobility of your knee and back, because we want to see if those joints are contributing to your hip symptoms. They'll want to look at how you move. How do you move from sit to stand? How do you walk? Do you limp, and so on? And design an exercise program for you that you can probably do at home to prevent further decline in your function or your symptoms.
And the other thing that they will definitely look at, Barbara, is your balance. Because mm-hmm. with this hip OA, as Lori alluded to, may come weakness, which could put you at risk for a fall. So they will probably also at some point along the rehabilitation process give you some balance exercises as well. And like Lori said, many of these things you'll be able to do at home. So it sounds like a great summer project.
Absolutely. Perfect.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a great time to start that.
Barbara, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Christopher in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Christopher.
Hello. On the internet and other places, I've come across a product with great claims for physical health, and that's like a vibrating board that you stand on. You turn it on, and it vibrates, and apparently all your muscles and joints get healed. True or false?
False. Well, I wouldn't say healed.
Not, you are healed.
Right, right.
No.
So a vibrating board, first of all, there's some evidence that it may actually help increase bone density. So there's that. And it may help, for lack of better terms, loosen up joints, kind of create that fluid pump to move fluid around in your articular cartilage. It's the fluid that kind of bathes your joints, if you will. Having said that, it's probably no different than moving your joints with exercise.
Right. And I think one of the things that it does is you're required to stabilize yourself on it as that thing vibrates. And so at a low level, you're firing a lot of your core and stabilizing muscles. So it probably has an impact on that as well. So is it going to cure all of your woes? Absolutely not. Is it something you could add to your exercise program? Yes, it is not a substitute for a good, well-designed exercise program.
Right.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling.
For bringing that up.
You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Bill in Cottage Grove. Hey, Bill, thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have prostate cancer, and I'm currently undergoing radiation. And I'm also on Lupron for hormone reduction. And I'm concerned about loss of muscle mass. I'm about a month and a half into the Lupron treatment. And just like to hear some suggestions on how to address reducing that loss of muscle mass and therapy.
Absolutely. So you have a lot of things going on. You have a lot of moving parts. So I can't remember where was Bill?
Cottage Grove.
Cottage Grove. Right, oh, okay.
Just outside of Madison.
So we have a physical therapist in the spine clinic that specializes in seeing patients who have cancer or are post-cancer treatment. And so she has expertise in this area and helping people remain healthy while they are undergoing their treatments and helping them get back into their life again post-cancer treatment. So I would absolutely see a physical therapist who has expertise in this area, understands the risks and benefits of various kinds of activities and so on, and get some guidance from someone who has real expertise in this area, because you are right to be concerned, especially right. with the Lupron and probably the fatigue you're feeling, mm-hmm. you know, with your treatments and so on. So getting the dose of that activity is going to be really important.
Right. And this has become a American Physical Therapy Association. This is a new area where physical therapists can actually become board certified, is in oncology. So this is a really up and coming area. Mm-hmm. So there's more people who are becoming experts in treating individuals.
During cancer. We're seeing people who are living longer
right.
with cancer mm-hmm. and people who are more concerned about their health during treatment.
Right,
they know they're going to come out on the other side of this, and they don't want to be digging themselves out of a really deep hole. So, Bill, you're right where you should be in being concerned about this and advocating for yourself to get some help. Right.
Would some of that be, let's take Bill might he be doing just like very minimal mm-hmm. kinds of exercises?
Yeah, it would. So that's where the physical therapy evaluation comes in. So, you know, if you have, you know, some muscle tendinopathy, you can probably look up online a bunch of exercises to do and maybe you'd get it right and recover. But something like this takes some real expertise to get the dosage right. What's the right intensity? What's the right number of repetitions? And that's what the article that we were talking about today was about. You know, we have a lot of information in our literature on which exercises help with certain things, but we don't always know the dosage. So the dosage comes from when that physical therapist examines that patient, puts their hands on that patient, tests their motion, tests their strength, watches the patient response. Are you fatigued? Are you sore? Does it create pain in order to get the dosage right?
Right. And with a patient who is going through radiation, there's so many other variables that mm-hmm. a specialist who understands the process, understands radiation, things like that. So it'd be very helpful to see that person.
I wonder if the certification program part of this might involve, to some extent, working on the mental side of things with a patient, or
it's
how
a great
you
question.
Approach working with patients.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's a very new certification.
But I would say that's true
for all the patients that we see.
Right, you think of yourself, Larry, when you were having your knee problem and you weren't able to get out for your walk. There's certainly a mental component to that of like, I'm frustrated mm-hmm. Because I can't do the things I want to do. Many of the patients that I see come to exercise in the pool because whatever pain they're having is limiting them from doing their usual exercise. They see that they're gaining weight. They see that they're having more pain and more discomfort, and they're just generally not feeling good. And they say, I want to stay healthy. So there is certainly a mental component to the rehabilitation program in almost any field. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Of physical therapy. But yeah, I would say especially for those working in oncology, absolutely, just because there's so many layers there.
Yeah. So Bill, does that help, Bill?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Liz in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I'm calling with a question about how long does one wait, you know, when you've been doing PT and you've had some improvement, but you're still not able to do, like, you can't hold down a job because of pain, you can't sit for longer than a half hour because of pain. Mm. And the mental piece that you talked about with the other client has definitely been something that has affected me. So,
and so you've worked a while with a PT person and you've made some gains, but not as many as you think you might have. Is that about right, Liz?
Yeah, well, and also, so you make the gains, but then if let's say I went to a concert last week and I sat for an hour and it kicked me back like probably 2 months of therapy. And so there's this frustrating piece.
Yeah, oh, I can see why.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely. So we'd love for your road to recovery to be this smooth, steady line when you're slowly increasing and getting up that hill. But I would say that that is never the case. I would say it's always a couple steps forward and then a plateau, or I slide back for whatever reason, then I have to dig forward again. I would say it's never a perfect straight trajectory with anybody, which can really add, Liz, to the frustration that you were speaking of.
So Liz, your question was how long to wait, and you didn't really finish that sentence. How long to wait for what? What's your alternative?
Before you sort of go back to the orthopedic and say,
oh, I see.
Like,
okay.
Mm-hmm. So that's,
I'm dealing with a posterior and an anterior tear in my right hip labrum.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I also have a herniated disc at L5S1. And what's happened is I have pain in the right hip and the buttock, and I get nerve pain occasionally down the leg. I've kind of worked myself out of that. That was prevalent for about a year. But you know, I was a personal trainer for many years, and so I'm dealing with a lot of sort of body injury type stuff.
Oh, sure. Right.
So for someone that was extremely active, uh-huh, now uh-huh, like a walk, a 20-minute walk, and I feel my hip hurting.
Okay, so, first of all,
this is a great question
and a very difficult question to answer. So you really don't want to intervene on the hip too much until you resolve your back. So if it were me, I would want to deal with the back pain and make sure that's clear, and then figure out what to do about the hip. And this would be a conversation with your PT. The PT should be giving you advice about, yeah, I think we've done everything we can and you're not moving forward. We've plateaued. We've tried sort of all the tools in our toolkit, and now it might be time to go back and see the surgeon. In terms of your activity, you know, I would try a pool. There's a lot of stuff you can do in a pool to help, you know, with your back, to recover with the back stuff, and to unweight your hip and do a lot of activity. So to feed that part of you that needs to stay active and needs to feel like they're doing something, I would get in a pool, and you can exercise very vigorously in a pool with your back situation and with your hip situation, and see if you can't get some of that under control and then see what's left.
So, and I think Lori hit the nail on the head when she talked about what's left. Have you had an injection in either of these, in your back or in your hip, to kind of sort through what pain is coming from where?
Yeah, so that process took, yes, I did have an injection in my hip. I also had an injection in my piriformis.
Oh, okay.
In the last year.
Okay.
Both helped a little bit, And it, that was sort of that diagnostic.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
And I hesitate to get another injection.
Sure.
You know?
Understood. No, I completely understand, especially if it didn't help that much.
Right. And because I've had the disc issue for 20 years and have gotten it under control, like I kind of know my body.
Sure.
And this feels hip.
Yeah, right, yeah, right, yeah. Yep. You know what your disc pain feels like.
Yeah, no question about that.
Yeah.
I just wondered, and I agree with you, I would not get another injection, but from a differential diagnosis, exactly like you said, Liz, sometimes it's helpful just to sort through because it's so difficult sometimes to tell where that pain is coming from. Is it truly my hip condition or my back? And it sounds like you have a good handle on that.
So I would have a conversation with my PT, who's been following you for these situations, and ask that person that same question.
Right.
When is it time to go back to see the ortho?
Right.
Because they would have a better handle on this.
When have I failed my conservative care?
Exactly.
Good luck, Liz. Right. And thank you so much for calling. I very much appreciate your call. You can join in too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. So, and I'm wondering when, now I don't know what happened in our caller's case, if this was a result of a serious accident or sometimes, and probably, there may have been something like that in her case, but there are other times when a pain starts and you think, well, I can work. I'm wondering, when do you go to somebody?
Well, for me,
let's take a little lower back since we started with that.
Or Lori's butt.
Yeah, or Lori's butt. It took me about 2 weeks to go to my sister and have her fix my butt pain.
There's nothing better than sticking a needle in your sister's glutes. Let me tell you, if you wanna just like get revenge for all those times when yesterday was my day.
Yeah, you winner, winner. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, again, Liz, you know your body. So, you know, I fussed with my butt pain for a couple weeks, and I tried some stretching, and I tried some strengthening, and I tried some ibuprofen, and I tried, you know, this and that. And I know that, so sitting was bothering me. And I know that later this week, I have to sit and drive about 9 hours. And so I was pressured by that boundary later this week. Like, I got to deal with this now. I might have fussed with it a little bit longer, but since it wasn't responding to any of the things that I was trying, like in a couple weeks, I just kind of said, yeah, that's enough. So.
Well, and the other thing you said, which when you said you tried running and you couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So there's an activity that I can't even modify. I had to completely cease that activity. And so that's always a big thing. I think understanding the difference between muscle pain and joint pain is something that patients have difficulty with. Muscle pain is more when you contract it or when you stretch it. And I feel like that has a tendency to kind of resolve more on its own. It's that joint pain. It's deep in the joint. I can't palpate it. That's nagging. It lasts into the night.
It wakes you at night.
Wakes me up at night. Those are the kind of things that I say, you know.
Better go.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Dave in Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Dave, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I hope I describe my situation properly. I've been having, I've had back surgery in the past, two or three of them. I also had my, if I'm saying it right, my sacroiliac on the right fused pins put in. And now I'm having a problem similar to that. You know, if I sit too long or whatever may cause it, I have very sharp pains that I have to move around, try to work out. I did go to a surgeon that does hip surgery, and he took x-rays, and everything in the hip seems to be just fine. He did find a spur or two. He was thinking that perhaps the pain in my butt is coming from either my sacroiliac or my back. but he had thought maybe have the sacroiliac checked first. You know, I'm kind of against injections and such, but I was told maybe to take something for the pain and see how that works. What's your opinion on that?
So why did you have your SI joint fused?
Well, I was having major pain in the back and hip, and it was recommended. I have a neurosurgeon that did my back surgery. He had recommended I have my sacroiliac checked out first.
Mm-hmm.
There was a problem in there, and there was movement in there, so we started there by fusing that.
Well,
initially, I thought it was a leg problem, but because the pain going down my legs. So we fused that. First, we did injections. That didn't take care of the problem. Then we fused it, and that didn't seem to take care of 100% of it, but it did help somewhat. And then I had my back taken care of, some disc fused and such, and that took care of the problem.
That's a lot of fusions.
So you have a couple fusions in your back, the surgeries. You said two or three, so you don't remember how many?
Sounded like three.
How many levels are you fused in your low back?
Three of them within the last 25 years. The last two of them were a lower back. And the worst case scenario was where, I don't know what to call it, the horse's tail where all the nerves go in.
Oh, the cauda equina.
The horse's head. Horse's head is out of the barn. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
So that was the worst one. Yep.
So we have a three-level fusion in the lumbar spine and a fusion in your SI joint on one side, which is very complicated. That's a mess. So, yeah, I don't know that I've seen an SI fusion. Have you?
No, not that anyone did voluntarily.
Correct.
You know, I've seen people with various autoimmune diseases where it fuses on its own.
Ankylosing spondylitis.
Right. So basically what you have is multiple joints that are supposed to move, and the only joint remaining that's allowed to move is your other SI joint.
And your hips. And I'm surprised.
And your hips.
It's great that your hips still look good, because that would be the next thing that's going to start breaking down.
So you need to see a physical therapist. And they need to examine your back and see where, if anywhere, there's some mobility. But you realize that at each segment of your spine and at your spine where it meets with your sacroiliac joint, there's supposed to be movement.
Right.
And so if you fuse them and they don't move, if you want to do your usual activities, walking, getting in out of a car, getting in and out of a chair, you have to steal that motion from someplace else, and you're running out of spaces. So that's a pretty complicated situation that you're presenting here. So I would absolutely go to a physical therapist and have them examine you and set you up on a program to prevent any further fusions down the road.
Correct. Yeah. Probably start in the pool.
Right. Starting the pool would be great. So what tends to happen, just for the other listeners, is you fuse one level in your lumbar spine, and what you do is you get increased motion above and below that fusion because that segment isn't allowed to move. So the levels above and below have to pick up the slack. Eventually, those
They'll
wear down because they're being overloaded, and then you end up with just sort of sequential fusion after fusion. Mm-hmm. And the spine surgeons are aware of this, and so they try not to fuse if they don't have to. But now, given where you're at, you're going to need to get with a good physical therapist who can help you try to find some motion someplace else and prevent any further deterioration.
Dave, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Looking at physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the UW-Madison. Lori's physical therapist and athletic trainer. Jill, a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk your health, your physical health, with our two guests, our physical therapist, Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Always great to have them come by. Certainly, if you have a question or maybe an experience to talk about, I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Dawn in Marshall next. Hi, Dawn.
Yes. Good morning. I have been in and out of physical therapy for my left hip. I have what's called CPPD, which is a pseudogout arthritis, and trying to deal with that. There is some degenerative tearing in my left hip. I am curious about, I keep hearing from QC Kinetics that they do plasma injections, stem cell injections to help rebuild cartilage. And the other question related to that is the hormones. I am about 62 years old now. I'm relatively active, big gardener, in the gym often. And I'm reading also that hormone replacement can help rebuild cartilage.
I have not heard that. That hormone replacement rebuilds cartilage. So they talk about using hormone replacement to prevent osteoporosis and bone loss, but I haven't heard about it for restoring articular cartilage. Mm-mm. Have you heard anything?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
So then we come down to the PRP. It sounds
QC
like the
kinetic.
And the PRP, which is platelet-rich plasma.
Right.
So the platelet-rich plasma technique that they're talking about is they take your own blood and they spin off the platelet-rich component of it, and then they re-inject that into the area to kind of create this healing environment to kind of foster
the growth healing. Of articular cartilage.
Yeah, the growth
and
of articular
healing.
Cartilage and healing and things like that. So the research behind PRP is all over the map. When it first came out, it was the hottest thing since sliced bread, and everybody was doing it, and we were PRPing a bunch of joints. And now, I'm pretty sure insurance is not paying for it.
Right, it's generally out of pocket.
And I'm guessing it's because the evidence is not overwhelming.
Correct.
Some people respond well in certain joints. Other people don't respond well in those joints. For me, it's all an all over the map thing. I can't say that I've consistently seen it. This is going to be a game changer in this joint.
No, I don't know that I've seen any patients who have had it done. I mean, I've seen some people have had it done in a tendon to try to stimulate. The idea is to try to stimulate the healing process in an area that doesn't have a blood supply.
Mm-hmm.
So I rarely see people who've had it. I've had some people who have, gone to the West Coast and had injections in their spine that haven't really done anything. I've not seen any group of people who have come back and said this did it for me. So it's not a place I would go. I would stick with the tried and true at this point. I would get in a pool if I were you, given those degenerative tears and the CPPD that you have, and your need to maintain an activity level. You say you go to the gym. Maybe there's a pool at the gym and you can get in and walk or do deep water running, deep water skiing, things like that to offload your hip.
Right.
Dawn, does that help?
The hip to be able to heal it. Because, I'm back in physical therapy again, and they're discussing just strengthening all the muscles around the hip to offload
the joint.
Right.
Uh-huh. Right.
And that is really what we're looking at. So some people will come in and they'll say, well, what is physical therapy going to do? You're not going to change my arthritis. So what we know is there's a very poor correlation between arthritis on imaging and people's symptoms. So there are people who have horrible radiographs but have relatively few symptoms, and we see the complete opposite. So it's not a great association there between those two things. Why do we strengthen? Because we need the muscles to do the workload.
To offload.
Moving, to offload the joint. So people who are sloppy movers, for lack of a better word, they use their joints to absorb the load of, say, walking or getting in and out of a car or whatever. They load their joints instead of using the muscles. I start out with very simple exercises, asking people to do a few simple things, and it's amazing how many of them really don't know that they're using their back, for example, instead of their hip muscles to raise their legs. So it's teaching you to use your muscles to do the things they're supposed to do, because we've gotten in years and years of habits that that place extra mm-hmm. loads on our joints. Mm-hmm.
Dawn, those are your marching orders. Good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see, Jean in Marquette, Michigan, are you there? No, Jean in Marquette, Michigan is not there, but there are some other callers coming online right now at 800-642-1234. And Rob in Wheaton, Illinois, as a matter of fact, is with us. So let's go there. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I just want to be a rah-rah person for ongoing proactive work with yourself. I am a disabled veteran as Marine Corps, and I don't give up. And I encourage other people, don't give up, because there's always more ways than you imagine out there. People talk about vibrating boards and all that. I deal with science and facts. And I have a great team of people that are helping me. I don't need any medicine, any pharmaceutical medicine to manage pain. I do it with acupuncture, yoga, and some other things like Reiki and Pilates. It's very involved, but it works. That's my bottom line.
That's great. It sounds like you really know your body well, what your body needs. And it sounds like, even though you didn't say it, it sounds like you have some mindfulness in this as well, Rob. If you're not doing pharmaceuticals, it sounds to me like you're doing some meditative things with yoga and things like that, which are also very helpful for pain management.
Yeah, one of the things that I see, interestingly, in people, because I've been at UW now, well, I don't want to say how, well, 37 years.
Wow.
37 years that I've been there. And so
You don't look like you've been there for 37 years.
Thank you, Larry.
By any means.
So, you know, I see people who come to our fitness center to exercise who used to be a patient mm-hmm. of mine. And those people who are continuing to exercise and take that to heart, like, they're in great shape, mm-hmm. you know, they're exercising. I'll never forget the day I had a woman come in and she stopped me and she said, "You didn't tell me it was going to take 5 years." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "You know, I'm doing great. I'm able to travel. I can lift up my grandkids. I can go to the mall and shop." She said, "But it took me 5 years." And mm-hmm. I remember when I started seeing her, how disabled she was and mm-hmm. how, you know, she had to move a bed to the first floor because she couldn't take stairs and was just really suffering. But she stuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
She stuck mm-hmm. with it for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And at that point, she's like, "I'm a new person. Right. I have a life again."
Right.
That's it's got to be satisfying.
Yeah, it sure is. Mm-hmm. It sure is.
Yeah.
To you, anybody in this line of work. Rob, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it very much. And you're on the right track from the sound of it.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is indeed. Well, how are you? Are you on the right track? Or maybe not, or maybe you need a little help. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program, our guest today, and they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. And Wayne and Prairie du Sac, I hope you can stay with us. What about you? Again, join in. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues with our two guests, Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Wayne in Prairie du Sac has a question for the two of you, so let's go to Wayne. Hi, Wayne.
Yeah, good afternoon. I have probably a relatively minor problem compared to a lot of them at this point, but I am basically a very healthy guy until I had a staph infection that colonized my bloodstream and my knee last fall very suddenly, which necessitated 13 days in the hospital and,
wow,
and four surgeries. Yeah, and four surgeries on the knee. And the last surgery was, it looks much like a knee replacement, but of course nothing's been replaced. Went kind of had to learn how to walk again and all this. But what's happening now, and I've been through physical therapy and everything, and I'm more or less back to normal. I'm still not able to run or play tennis or anything like that, but I can bicycle and do these things. But the thing that continues, and I've been released from physical therapy, and this is thus my question, is right along the incision, in particular right at the knee joint, I still have this very tight feeling when I bend it a lot of times, or if I've had it straight for a long time, it feels almost like it's going to split open. I know it won't, but that tightness is there, and I'm wondering if there's anything I can do for that.
So that's not uncommon to have, you know, with a big incision like that at a joint line when you bend to create some tension there, especially if the incision is adhesed or stuck to some of the connective tissue layers below it, whether it's actually stuck to some muscle or some connective tissue. So there are things that can be done for that. In my practice, what I would do is I would put you in a seated bent position, and then I would use some sort of soft tissue instrumented tools such as Graston or augmented soft tissue mobilization or something like that to try and loosen that up and then have you work that range of motion. I don't know how much more you would get back. I think a lot of it depends on the adhesions and how sticky you are, but that would be worth a try.
So if you put your fingers on that incision and try to move that skin over the tissue below, does it move or is it sort of stuck?
Yeah, no, it does move. And of course, I've still got some dead spots and stuff too, but the actual, it does move.
Okay.
And actually feels rather good when I do that, so I continue to do that.
Yeah, right, good, yes. good.
I usually tell people to take a piece of their TheraBand, their resistive band, and put that over the incision with your finger so you can get a nice grip. And you can grip that skin and then move it all directions, up, down, diagonally, circles, et cetera, to make sure that it moves in all directions. And it seems like continuing to do that massage there may have a pain-relieving effect. So I would continue doing that. I'm not sure there's a lot of other options.
Well, the only other thing is, I'm always wondering if it's the joint, if he needs a little bit of joint mobilization or distraction at that joint. And then B, the other thing that comes to mind for me for that scar is the plunger.
The plunger.
So
what the heck
go
is
ahead,
that?
Jill.
So, since you asked. So Lori talked about moving the scar all different directions, up, down, side to side, all of those things, which is fantastic. And so many patients will just say, I feel like the scar just needs to be lifted. And there is a physical therapy product. It looks like a sink plunger that you would get at a hardware store, but it is not. It is a little softer than that. And you put it on and it creates suction similar to a cupping technique. And then you can pull the skin or the soft tissue up and kind of create a little bit of separation between whatever's below. So you can kind of almost distract the skin that way. And that might be something that helps Wayne as well.
Can Wayne go out and buy one of those? I mean, how are they really expensive?
No, they're $7. No, no. Yeah. They're $7.
$7, Wayne.
But it would be helpful to see a physical therapist and have them show you how to use it.
Yeah.
And many PTs can help you purchase one online through that. So it may be worth, like Lori said, I would definitely rub all that around.
Right.
But it may be worth a revisit to a physical therapist to see, is there anything else I can do with my scar? Is this my joint? And if I could do this at home to manage it, do I need some sort of equipment, a.k.a. a $7 plunger?
So, and the plunger works really well for your kneecap. For those people who have arthritis underneath their kneecap and have a lot of kneecap pain.
Love it.
The plunger is the best thing
for
that.
So where do you put the plunger on it for that kind of situation?
You put it right over the knee. So it's
right
about
over the top of the knee.
It's about,
it goes around it.
Mm-hmm, it's about the diameter of a...
It's about 3 to 4 inches in diameter.
And then you create a seal.
With Vaseline or something.
And then you can pull up on it to pull your knee cap up and unload it. I bet you would love it, Larry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although I haven't had...
Right, you're good. Knock on wood.
My knee's still okay now.
So anyway, so that might be something that Wayne wants to try, or it works very well for people with patellofemoral pain, and I've also had people have good luck with it with greater trochanteric bursitis.
Oh, really?
I can kind of unload there.
Mm-hmm. I think I can. That's the first time we've ever talked about the plunger.
A plunger. Wow. Yeah.
It's you know, I'd like to say there's solid evidence behind it, but it would fall under the category of manual therapy, manual mobilization, and just it helps move the joint, the knee, the scar in a different direction.
Right. So you would go into your physical therapist. And so, for example, we have techniques where we would mobilize your kneecap. Right. We kind of pull up on it. We move it all different directions. We do some deep tissue massage. And then, but, you know, if you see your PT once a week or once every 2 weeks, like, that's not enough. So you need some tool at home, and the plunger was a great asset. When somebody discovered that.
It's one of those things that, gosh, why didn't we think of that?
Well, it doesn't matter so much because we couldn't make any money off a $7 plunger.
Yeah, at least they're not $100 or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wayne, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jerry and Hudson, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. I'm calling about, I have severe osteoporosis, in part because I'm soon going to be 80. And this year, they discovered that I had an overactive parathyroid gland, and I've recently had surgery on that. My endocrinologist wants to follow that up with bone-building infusions, like Fosamax or I can't think, I just blanked on the other name. I know there are pros and cons on that, and a friend of mine, family are physical therapists, and they're going, no. I can't do heavy exercise to help strengthen my bones because I also have severe scoliosis that I've had since childhood. So what are your opinions on those drugs and the safety of that? I'm very small boned, and you know those are my issues, but I know he's going to push for me to take that drug.
So let me ask this. What was your friend's rationale for saying you shouldn't go with the medication?
Because they were seeing patients, I think, that have had that, and they're dealing with the after effects of it.
Such as?
What are the after effects? That's what we're asking.
I haven't had a chance to sit down with them in detail.
The only side effects that I know of Fosamax are the mandibular
joint pain
and mandibular softening of the bone, which is a very... I've never seen anyone with it. I've only read it in the literature that is a risk.
Yeah. I see many people with osteoporosis who are on a variety of either injections or medications. And I'm not seeing that. The risk of a fracture generally exceeds the symptoms that you might have from these medications. To me, this is a conversation to have with your endocrinologist where you sit down and have a heart-to-heart on the risks and benefits
of the medication, and you can weigh the risks against the benefits. You can ask your endocrinologist for information or evidence for these choices in medications. I think the fact that you are unable to do a lot of exercise because of your scoliosis kind of tips the scales into limiting your options for building bone. So I guess that's the thought process I would use.
Right. I mean, we still know that one of the best ways to build bone is through exercise, and you would be limited. You could do some in the pool, although the pool isn't a great place for bone building because of all the
unweighting
in the pool. So yeah, you might be a tad limited. So I agree with Lori.
Yeah.
I haven't heard very few people with negative side effects on those drugs.
No,
Jerry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Corrine in La Crosse next. Hi, Corrine.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is going to be exciting.
Oh, we're so excited.
All right, we're hanging on every word.
For me, when I was 24, I had a tumor. I had to have my femur was totally deteriorated, so they had to put a pin in. That was when I was 24. I was 64 years old then. No, wait a minute. I was 64 years old. I was 34 years old.
Was that an osteosarcoma? Anyway, was that an osteosarcoma?
I really don't know what it was because I had this Russian doctor who was absolutely wonderful. He put this pin in and sent me home in an ambulance. We didn't have an ambulance in town that time. I had home in a hearse, a big blue hearse.
Oh, you said you came. I had to pause for a minute to make sure you said you came home in a hearse. Okay, all right. That's a first.
So I did really well. Well, then I came to La Crosse, and doctor here took the pin out and did a bone marrow transplant. And I was pretty good for, like, for 20 years. You know, I could water ski and do all kinds of things. And then the hip was starting to show deterioration, so decided we should have to do a hip replacement. That was in 2016. Had the hip replacement, and it just was not feeling well afterwards. I mean, I had both my knees done prior to that and then the hip. So anyhow, I just kept thinking there's something wrong here because I was having incredible pain. I hit hard and then go away right away. And nobody could find what was wrong at my clinic here. I'm not going to see what the clinic was. I went down to Dr. Lawrence in Viroqua. If you heard of him, he's amazing. Mm-hmm. He right away diagnosed I had what's called the abductor lurch. The incision was pulling away. It was just like a zipper opening and closing. So I went to Dr. Sierra in Rochester. He did what's called a total abductor repair. I was in a cast for 6 weeks.
Wow.
And then you know, when you get after the cast, just to keep it straight and
a brace.
And I lost track of my, a brace, yes. And I had to wear that for 6 weeks. Then I went into physical therapy and it was physical therapy and I worked hard. I'm an 83-year-old woman. I do yard work, I swim, I bike, I go to the Y.
But you're still struggling to some extent?
Yes. I still walk with a really bad, I call it the lurch. Oh. And when I went to down, they called it abductor lurch, which was really strange because I was referring to the lurch. So I still need to use a cane, which irritates me. And I have no choice. But I just, and I've gone to physical therapy, and whoever Dr. North Maryland gets was wonderful. The pain, she dealt with the minor Marino, focusing on that area and really working on it. And that day I left that clinic and I didn't have any more pain. I kept doing the exercise, but it helped getting that muscle. She could feel the muscle activating because I was really focusing on it. So I've been really careful when I work out to focus on wherever. I've had sports medicine people here. I have a friend that's a sports medicine massage.
So you're still struggling.
So that you got that hip abductor muscle working again. You had surgery to repair it, and then you got the muscle working, but you're still limping?
Mm-hmm. You're still limping a lot. Medius
limping a lot, yeah.
So the question is, when they had to repair her gluteus medius, was there enough damage such that she's always going to have a deficit in that muscle? That's my only thought.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know that.
This.
That would be a question for somebody who actually examined her.
100%. Yeah. Or the surgeon, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Marilyn, what we're talking about is if when you had that gluteus injury and they went in and repaired it, was were they able to repair it so the muscle could get back to 100% strength? Or maybe there was so much muscle involvement that they thought, gosh, the best we're ever going to get Kareem back to is 50% or 60%. And Lori and I can't answer that question, but that's kind of the thought running through both of our minds right now.
Yeah, if you're at 50%, you're not going to be able to walk without a limp.
Right, exactly. And if you've done everything that you're supposed to be doing.
And it sounds like you are very aware of what you're supposed to do. You're aware of activating the muscle. It may just be that there's not enough muscle there to support you in single leg stance.
Right.
But she could go back and ask.
She sure could.
Yeah,
she
could go back and just see if there's anything else that can do. The surgeon might be able to tell you how much of that muscle that
is left.
Is left. Correct. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And that would answer your question. I don't know that it's going to solve your problem, but it would answer your question.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There you go.
Keep working hard on everything you're doing. Stay active.
You're doing all the right
stuff.
Go into the water. Swimming, going to the gym. That's all good stuff.
Yep.
Kareem, thank you. Ray in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Ray.
Thank you, Larry. I'm 82 years old, and I'm having trouble walking. And I was wondering if there's any therapy that would do me any good to get me walking again. I've fallen over frontwards, and I've fallen over backwards. But I need something to get me going straight again.
Yeah, okay.
Do you live at home, Ray?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. We
not only yes, but heck yes. This is our wheelhouse.
We are very concerned about your falls because there's risk of fracture, there's risk of hitting your head and a subdural hematoma and all sorts of terrible things that can start a big downward spiral. What is your difficulty with walking? Is it weakness or is it pain in your joints?
Or balance.
Or balance.
Balance.
Okay. There you go.
So physical therapy, this is something we do every day. So they're going to take a look at you and look at the mobility in your joints and look at the strength of your muscles. So sometimes balance problems are due to weakness in your muscles. Sometimes it's due to knowing where you are in space. And so a good physical therapy assessment will look at those things and then design a program for you that may consist of some strengthening, some practicing balance stuff. So one of the great places for you to exercise would be a pool. This is something that I see all the time. And why a pool? Because you can exercise without all the weight on your joints. Sometimes what limits people is, you know, if I'm on my feet too long, my knees hurt or my hips hurt or my back hurts. But we don't have that situation in the pool. Plus, we can really challenge your balance in a lot of ways, and you're not going to fall over and hurt yourself. You're going to lose your balance a little bit, but in the pool, everything gets slowed down, so you have an opportunity to regain your balance. So we do a tremendous amount of balance work in the pool, but absolutely see a PT.
The other thing your physical therapist may suggest is an assistive device. Mm-hmm. So they may suggest a wheeled walker for you or a cane with a wider base of support or something like that, which will make negotiating your house easier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. Safety is going to be number one.
Yep.
Good luck, Ray. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Ann in Green Bay. Ann, hello.
Yes, hello. I was wondering if you know, I have proximal hamstring tendinopathy.
Yep.
And I've been on statins and rosuvastatin for many, many years. Would that cause a problem with that healing?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I don't think the statins would interfere with healing at all. So
yeah, I don't think so either.
No, that's not something. So statins sometimes create some muscle pain.
Myalgias,
but it's not been associated with tendinopathies that I've seen. Most of the tendinopathies are degenerative.
Mm-hmm.
Degeneration of the tendon for one reason or another. So are you in rehabilitation at all for your tendinopathy?
Yeah, I've been
doing physical therapy. I do a lot of yoga, Pilates. I exercise a lot. I'm not overweight. I'm trying some laser mm-hmm. right now and some other shock therapy. Mm-hmm. I did PRP and that didn't work for me. So I'm just trying a number of different things. Acupuncture.
I feel like proximal hamstring tendinopathies are the kitchen sink approach. Mm-hmm. So besides good mobility and strengthening, trying all those other things is probably a good strategy. And I feel as we age, and I don't know, I think menopause may be a factor in this. I feel anecdotally that this is a demographic we see this in a lot, and it takes a long time to heal. Kind of the same with the gluteal tendinopathies.
Right. So again, the question is why one and not the other?
Correct.
Is there any asymmetry, or was there any activity where you felt yourself mm-hmm. strain or overdo it? Or, mm-hmm. you know, a classic in the spring is shoveling in the garden where mm-hmm. you put your foot on a shovel and you're doing mm-hmm. pushing because you tend to do it with the same leg over and over. Mm-hmm. So,
Anne, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. John emailed to say they have pain in the right shoulder diagnosed by a physical therapist over Zoom as originating in a tendon. The PT had John push hard on his first rib by the neck in that little hollow behind the collarbone.
Mm-hmm.
It relieved the pain almost magically, but temporarily. And John wonders if these pushes treat the symptom or the cause.
Well, without seeing John, I don't know that we would have a good answer for that. He could have two different things going on and have an elevated first rib,
mm-hmm.
which could be bringing him forward a little bit. And I'm guessing he has biceps tenodesis, more than likely, is the tendon that was probably the problem in his right shoulder.
Yeah.
And so it'd be hard to know which one came first, the chicken or the egg, without seeing John.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of variables there. So, you know, I would say, if it's relieving his symptoms, continue to do the mobilization. And if you, over time, get longer-lasting relief, then you know that something was happening there causing your symptoms. If not, it's an incidental finding.
Right. Right, exactly.
What we would call an incidental finding. All mm-hmm. right.
Yep.
Well, on that note, it's kind of interesting to have that last one come over Zoom because mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about.
Oh, yeah. AI.
AI mm-hmm. and a little bit of that. But in the meantime, thank you both.
Yeah. Sure. Yes. It's been great. Once again, great calls, great mm-hmm. questions.
Yep.
And we'll do it all over again in about 30 days.
That sounds great.
That's what I'm guessing.
Thank you, Larry.
You got it.
Lori Tyne Brody, a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Joe Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. They come by about once a month to talk about these issues, and they will do it again next month. Thank you for listening. Coming up, artificial intelligence in the healthcare field. I'm Larry Mueller. You know, artificial intelligence seems to be, and I think it actually is, pretty much everywhere these days. And we are going to take a look now at how AI is affecting healthcare. Larry Mueller here for WPR News, and our guest is Cheryl Goswami. Cheryl Goswami is UW Health Chief Information and Digital Health Officer, and recently UW Health hosted a roundtable in Washington, D.C., more than 30 leaders in government, healthcare, and tech talked about AI in healthcare. And I want to talk with him about why or what they talked about and how AI is affecting maybe your healthcare. And of course, we want to hear from you as we go along today. What questions do you have about AI and its use in medical settings? Have you had an experience? Love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Cheryl Goswami, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Good afternoon, Larry. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
So why did UW Health feel it was important to have this roundtable discussion in D.C.?
Well, I think you said it very well in your opening comment. Everybody needs to know something or has an opinion about artificial intelligence. And as a leading academic medical center in the country and a pioneer in adopting this technology over a year ago with our colleagues at Epic and developing that software, we felt it was imperative upon us to be responsible leaders and work with our legislators and members of our executive branch of the national government to share some of the opportunities, some of the concerns, some of the shared risk and rewards that we in the healthcare provider area can gain working with our partners at the national government. Hence, we took it upon ourselves to build this coalition, if you may, of peers and had this roundtable 2 weeks ago.
So there were, I think, two discussion sessions, if I'm not. The first one was on the patient care and experience side of AI in healthcare. What problems is AI solving for healthcare systems? And I'll probably also ask you, what are they not solving?
Well, it's problems and opportunities both, right? So as everyone will agree across our country, healthcare staffing shortages are well documented. These shortages are impacting patient care. There is burnout. 4 years past COVID, we are still having issues with staff. A lot of folks, our jobs are not being filled, so on and so forth. And so we look upon this as a form of where we can augment the human labor and try to start doing some work that technology can help do and reduce the burden on our provider and our care teams, which in turn leads to a better patient experience for our patients and their families. So that was the main aspect of the patient care and experience. And in my own words, I will say UW Health approaches this with the scale of how can we make our providers efficient? That's number one. Two, how can we do this with the right ethics? Ethics matter because we're dealing with personal data of our patients and providers. And three, how do we do this with an equity mindset to ensure that there is no further discrimination in any form across our patient base? And finally, the most important piece is technology is never going to replace the human in this ecosystem of providing care. So the empathy for which we all signed up to practice in healthcare should never be compromised just because there is a technology embedded in the process. And that's what we took to the table when we went to Washington, D.C. to say, how can we do all that in improving patient care?
Mm. John in Hayward has a comment that may relate to this. John, hello.
Yes, hey, Larry, this is John.
Hi, John, what's on your mind?
Well, I'll tell you what, Larry, I am just scared out of my wits that this AI is going to take over everything, you know? It just feels like robots taking over the world, you know, kind of, and I'm very scared of it.
You know, I bet you're not alone, John. I bet you, Cheryl, this is something you've heard.
100%, John, and I could have very well expected this question, and we should be scared to a certain extent, which is why leadership comes with responsibility, and I can speak from our perspective. Just because technology can do some things doesn't mean technology should do it. There is a right place and a right time for technology to be incorporated. In all the things that we have done to this day and for all our plans going forward, I use the line, the human in the middle will continue to stay. And so by having the human being, it is driving the responsibility of the technology and is also assuring our patients and providers that we are just not having a bot talk directly to the patient or take care of that. So that's what our position is. That's where I would say most responsible health systems across the country, most responsible vendors in the health system are taking place. Beyond that, there is always a possibility that, you know, people are going to abuse technology, which actually, to Larry's point, was the second part of the discussion as to where does regulation and the role of government come in sort of giving us some guidelines, some frameworks, and holding people accountable and responsible for their actions.
Yeah.
I hope that answers your question.
So, you know, typically when I think about AI, I think about, and I've had at least one online, I think it was a Zoom meeting with my own physician, somebody I've worked with and known for a long, long, you know, practically my whole professional life. So it worked out fine for me. But I'm wondering, not there. So there's that aspect of talking with your physician or nurse or whatever online. In what other ways is AI being used in the arena of patient and healthcare?
Thanks, Larry, for that question. I think it'll be worthwhile to go back and look in a brief retrospective on the journey
Sure.
of AI. So AI has been around for a long time. I would say easily over 30 years. Artificial intelligence in many ways has been used in the healthcare arena and many other domains for a long time. Back in the day, where artificial intelligence could look at your data and predict that you may be at a certain risk to a certain kind of a disease or so on and so forth, and from the providers to take better care of you. AI has been around in our own personal lives for a long time. Self-driving cars have been around for a while. You've had, whether you're using an Apple phone with Siri or Google with Alexa or stuff like that, that's all some forms of artificial intelligence, which have been around for decades, if not years. Where we are talking in the last 15 to 20 months is where it has suddenly become to an expanded scale, where it is starting to use in conversational AI, in sort of what we call deterministic AI, and almost near real time, where you can now go to ChatGPT, ask a question, and it can tell you everything that you would like to know about it, which has made it very easy to do the right thing and very easy to do the wrong thing. I think that context of AI over the last 30 to 40 years is important, setting the context over here. From our perspective, the way I look at it, this is the first time we are going past data and numbers, and we're getting into emotions where we are talking about people's health. We are talking about, you know, people's outcomes, which is very different, and which is where John's question is very appropriate. It makes things risky. And it's become affordable. Until very recently, you and I could not go out and buy a server or a system that could do all these AI things. So suddenly it has become sort of mainstream. AI has broken all records over the history of technology in its adoption to the first million mark, which I think happened in 5 days. It would take years for Facebook or the internet to take over. So those are the things that we have to set in context, that the ease of availability, the affordability, that makes this a double-edged sword.
Yeah, it's there are some concerns. I was thinking about the doctor's appointment. When I go to see the doctor, I've got to drive to see the doctor. I've got to park. I may have to, even though the appointment is for 10 in the morning, or 9 in the morning, I may have to, that may not happen right on at the appointed time. And you're suddenly looking at a fair amount of time involved for maybe a 20 or 30 minute visit.
You're right on. And COVID has exposed that possibility even further, right, over the last 4 years. And so at a broader scale beyond Madison, if you start thinking of rural healthcare, this is where technology can be a part of the solution to the bigger problem of accessing providers and health systems in a timely manner. I'm not saying it fits everybody's needs. And we live in an environment where a great deal of individuals still want to sit across the table from their provider and care team and talk to them. But for others, like a wellness visit or something more or less acute, a video visit could work just as well. And so used appropriately, technology should augment all of those, never replace any of those in that care setting. Time is a precious commodity. Mm-hmm. So if you're driving an hour, parking for 30 minutes, running late for 45 minutes and all of that, and you can do with a 20-minute appointment, absolutely, we can do that.
I'm wondering, to what extent is AI used among doctors? So
again,
you've got somebody, I don't know, where in some part of northern Wisconsin or some part of Wisconsin, and, you know, I'm not sure about this, or maybe I want to talk with some other physician about the same thing.
Yeah, so this is like many other things. One size doesn't fit all. And so for many years, AI has been used more on the background or the back end of systems, where what we call decision support systems, where we look at your data and we prompt certain things, and the doctors can or cannot ask certain questions to get further information for your prognosis and diagnosis. That has been around for a while. Today, what it really helps is allowing us to help those physicians in northern Wisconsin that you talked about have the expertise and exposure to academic medical center settings, sitting in Madison or Rockford, that can help the provider, 100 miles, 200 miles away, without having to transport the patient from that setting onto our health system in Madison, which in itself poses a risk to the patient. We tend not to force providers to use these tools. We do proof of concepts, because this is not just about the technology, it is the adoption of the technology. And just like a smartphone 20 years ago or an electric vehicle 10 years ago, not everybody moves at the same pace to accept all new things. Change management adoption is very key.
Chiro Goswami, our guest today, UW's Health Chief Information and Digital Health Officer, as we talk AI and healthcare. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Just wanted to mention, we're gearing up for our June member drive. It's a one-day drive on the 27th of June, and we're looking for 500 people to get us started. And when we reach that goal before the 27th, our programs will receive an additional $10,000 from a group of generous members. So you could join and become part of that first 500 with your gift at WPR.org/donate. Let's take another call. Ralph in Green Bay, it's your turn. Ralph, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I just tuned in and I heard your guest talk to the point of an earlier caller being concerned about artificial intelligence taking over. I believe the comment was, but people are in between the artificial intelligence and what it can do and the results. My comment or concern would be, who's that person or people in between the artificial intelligence and what could they do with it? And what came to mind is the Hitler era, the Nazis. What if they had the artificial intelligence and they're the people in between society and what harm artificial intelligence could do? It's like, I suppose, a nuclear bomb or anything else. As we've seen today, rapid firing weapons, what they can do, and the weapons alone aren't the problem. It's the people, and how do you, when you have something as powerful as what artificial intelligence can and will be someday.
Yeah. How do you, if there's that bad, kind of a bad person, let's say, in the middle, I think that's a good point to discuss, Chiro.
Very, very good point. You can't have the fox guarding the coop, as the line goes. So in order to protect that very conflict of interest here, Larry, what we have done is, in all our cases today, the human in the middle is a member of the care team, a clinician or a provider or a nurse. I want to be very clear about that. And allow me to get into a detail on the very scenario that we are playing out. And we're doing this at a very slow pace because this is not a race. Getting it right is important than being fast. So an example that we use is when a patient sends a message for certain kind of messages, and these are very low on the acuity or in the terms of criticality, the system generates a response. Every one of those responses is then reviewed by a member of the care team, not by a technology member, not by a member of the vendor, not by somebody sitting outside the shores of the United States of America. It is a UW health professional that reviews the message. And the individual then has a couple of choices. The person has a choice to accept the message, saying, this is exactly the way to answer the question. Yes, you should be able to do that, patient so-and-so, depending on the question. The provider may say, it gets the gist of what my answer is, but Larry Miller speaks a certain way. I am going to put a couple of my own words, a couple of my own sentences, so as to put my signature on it and add all of that. Or may come back and say, I don't like the answer this has been created, and deletes the whole thing. And as a human being would do, create it from scratch and put the response back and send it, which is why we have this thing called ethics that I touched on at the start of the show. By having a member of the provider team taking care of those messages, being a member who's responsible for the care of the patient, we are reducing the abuse that potentially the technology could provide. I hope that helps.
Yeah, it does indeed. I want to keep on that line, but I do want to make sure we discuss for at least a bit about the role of a little more about the role of government, as you discussed, in terms of regulating AI in healthcare, as you discussed at your meetings in Washington, D.C.
So on the role of the government, as we talked about, it has the potential, the AI has the potential to address some of our concerns with access, Larry, using your example. However, to our second caller's point, as we drive this innovation, we all know that the government also has to give us certain guidelines, frameworks, and I'll use the word protection, you know, from certain vendors and certain products. Using the very example of Hitler and Nazi, what happens if certain private companies go out and create all of this, and many of them can do it outside the shores of North America, and all of that gets embedded into the use in our environment without the protection, and not everybody may take the higher road that UW Health does in having that human in the middle to create that extra safety check, to have that high bar of ethics and empathy, and everything now becomes about talking to somebody else. Where does that go in terms of defining concepts and managing, you know, the bias and the accuracy that this technology can wreak havoc with? So that was a part of the conversation that we wanted our federal regulators to be aware that we need their support in the innovation, sustainment, and protection while we do this from our side.
Yeah. I wondered how the whole meeting went. Was there how did the conversation go on? Were there consensus on any of this, or?
So if you were to ask me what was the desired outcome of this conversation, and we were there for about 4 hours, and a couple of us met with individual members and staffers of the House of Congress, the primary purpose was to generate awareness. The primary purpose was to burst some myths, because everybody today has an opinion about AI, as you started the show with. And this was our way of saying this is not one health system, but leading healthcare systems, along with responsible partners like Epic, that are coming and saying, this is what it looks like from our lens. And while you make certain decisions, you need to just keep in mind that the patients in northern Wisconsin or southern Wisconsin are very different than the patients of northern California or southern California. So where does that national versus local governance play? And so with all of this awareness, the hope is in the next 4 to 6 weeks, we will publish, you know, some of our findings, some of the conversations. And this is a journey, And it was important to get the step to say, here's what we would like you to consider from our perspective.
Yeah. So you took away from this, you were happy about the results of that discussion.
I would say so based on the feedback we received from almost 100% of the participants that this was the first of many conversations that they have seen in this kind, because otherwise it's a very slanted approach where you have somebody selling technology or somebody asking for a price protection or somebody asking for, you know, carte blanche approval for something. So this was not lobby politics. This was presenting healthcare in its simplest form.
How did you land in the healthcare field? I mean, you're obviously somebody who is very skilled and knowledge in this whole area and been doing it a long time. How'd you land in healthcare?
Are you asking about me specifically?
Yeah.
Purely by accident. I did not grow up in healthcare. I worked in other industries, had a couple of, let's just say, less than fortunate incidents with close family members. And so about 18 years ago, when an option came up as to serve in healthcare, I thought I could go and, make a difference. And I will say 18 years later, it is the art of possible, where I can use technology to make a difference in making healthcare more affordable for the next generation. I got two boys. That's what keeps me in healthcare.
That's great. What are some ways that, or no, let me put it this way. What are patients likely to see now going down the road? What are some things that we might expect to see in the next few years in terms of AI and health?
So I would say, if we have a crystal ball, knowing that every 6 weeks, it feels like the outlook keeps changing. I think that in the next 12 to 18 months, the first set of benefits will be indirect to the patient as healthcare providers use this technology primarily to reduce the burden on administrative tasks. I stress on the word indirect because it is appropriate that we use the technology for less critical things, get those right first before we expose the risk to something directly in the care of the patient. So the indirect benefits may come in terms of, you know, quicker appointments, lesser errors in their bills, their prescription refills coming in faster, so on and so forth. There is technology that is being piloted or tested right now that also starts dealing with on the prevention side of the house. So how can I look at Larry Miller's, I hope you're okay with me using, he was an example,
sure,
of your data, and say, Larry, based on all the data we have and the technology that we have at our disposal, you may be at risk for a certain type of a cardiac issue 3 years from now. So those are also the things in terms of prevention that can also help, in avoiding a visit to a hospital, which is difficult to start with, as you said. So this is a journey. It is about reducing the cost of healthcare today, which is significant. It is also about reducing the burden on the care provider who are getting burnt out. And if you don't have a physician today, it means a longer wait time for your patients, which means the patients also gain from that use of the technology. And most of all, it also actually does drive the safety and quality of care, which we often tend to forget in these conversations.
Some doctors I've talked with off, not on the air, have said, have complained about the amount of time they have to spend on on essentially it's paperwork, but it's not necessarily, it's in a computer, but it's called paperwork.
Imagine the irony of that. And you're spot on. I have had a resident back in the day tell me that I went to med school and I've become the fastest typist in my family. and it's unfortunate, but that's the world we live in. That all of this information needs to be typed in. Now, beyond AI, we are also talking about other technologies where how can we return the doctor back to the patient? How can we get the doctor to watch the patient in the eye versus looking at the keyboard? So there are other technologies that we are bringing to the forefront that actually captures the conversation between Larry and Chero, if you may, translates it into something that goes on the record that, again, the doctor, back to that second question earlier, the doctor that can then edit and make it accurate. So all of those things, in my way of saying, is it returns the care team back to the care of the patient and not all computer data entry operators.
Chero Goswami, thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we can do this again down the road. I appreciate it very much.